supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it is a doubleheader question of the week. The common denominator is winter. What should you do to protect your plants from hungry deer, mice, voles, and rabbits over winter? And what should you do to protect them from the most dangerous predator in your environment? You. We'll tell you all about it after lots of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Eric, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Eric. How are you, man?
I'm good, thank you.
And where is Eric good?
I'm in Glenside, Pennsylvania, just outside Philadelphia.
All right. Very good. Eric, what can we do you for?
Well, my wife and I are doing some experimenting, and we decided to try to propagate some hydrangea cuttings. And we were very successful out of 16, 13 lived. One was eaten by a rabbit. And I'm just curious, they're about 3 inches tall. They're well-rooted. How should I store those during the winter? Just mulch them or bring them inside? I don't know what to do.
Okay, let's back up and revisit the scene of the crime where all these chalk marks are on the floor. Now, what time of year did you take the cuttings?
Well, we did it in probably beginning of August.
Okay, so pretty much a time when no one anywhere takes any cuttings. That's a very interesting situation.
Well, now, we've never been successful before. We were experimenting, and we are actually very surprised at our success.
Okay. Now, how do you know you have success? Are these puppies sitting in water?
No, we put them, we mixed half soil, potting soil, and half fine pine bark mulch. We put them in cups. And we put those, planted the cuttings. We make sure there were stems that had no flowers on them. We cut the leaves back, left just the top row of leaves, cut those leaves in half, and put some root tone on them and put them in our soil.
Oh.
Put them in a plastic sealed box for 1 month. We had watered them first, didn't even touch them or look at them, and took them out that a month later, and you know, they're all well-rooted.
Despite anything you did, man, there's never any reason to use bark mulch in any
okay.
kind of rooting situation. You were right to use the potting soil, but you're lucky anything germinated in the wood other than mushrooms. That's absolute nonsense, and somebody just made it up freehand. So where are these paper cups, styrofoam cups with rooted cuttings in them?
Right now, I have them in a raised bed. I put them in there beginning of September, and they're sitting in this raised bed. And I just want to know whether to leave them or pot them and bring them in.
Are they in or out of their cups?
Out of the cups.
And they're sitting in soil with their roots in soil?
Correct.
Is this where you want them to grow?
No.
Where do you want them to grow?
I want to use them in front of my house and replant them as I'm redoing some things in the front in the spring.
So you do not have a spot for them yet?
Correct, I do not, because I'm doing some construction there, and I'm afraid if I put them in now, they might be trashed from the construction.
Okay, all right. Well, your best bet is to simply leave them where they are. Do not disturb them. Don't dare bring them inside. Hydrangeas do need to experience the seasonality of outdoors. If things get really dicey over the winter, you may lose them, because this was not the ideal way to do it. You know what? I'm going to suggest you also do what are called some hardwood cuttings. You can take two different kinds of cutting to propagate plants.
Okay.
Softwood cuttings, which you take from fresh growth in the spring, and hardwood cuttings, which you take at the end of the season. What you would go out and do now is cut off some hardwood, just some hardwood cuttings from the plants, just like the phrase says. Literally,
okay.
just tie them up with string, and then dig a little hole and bury them with a marker on top. And then in the spring, dig up those hardwood cuttings that have experienced the cold weather, and you would root those similar to the way you did, but you would use pots with just the lightest, loosest potting soil you can find. You would hang a plastic bag over them to increase the humidity inside. You would not seal it, and you would keep it out of direct sun. and you'd lift the bag and missed the cuttings like every day. And then after a month, they should develop their own roots, and then they can be planted where they want to grow. Conversely, like the sneakers, you could also cut fresh new green growth that appears in the spring and either do the same thing with that, or if you're feeling lucky, improve the soil in the area where you want to plant them and just gently put those cuttings in there and see if they root. Again, you would keep them really well watered until they did develop new growth to show that they had new roots, and you would miss them every day. With the hardwood cuttings, yes, you would do a little humidity temp, but don't seal it and don't let it in direct sun, or you could cook your cuttings.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your help. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, man.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Leo, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Leah. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm just ducky, thank you. Where is Leah well?
I am in Mickleton, New Jersey. It's close to Philly.
Okay, good. All right, what can we do for Leah in the Garden State?
I have a massive silver maple in my yard.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
But I love it. I really love it. But I'm worried about it.
You should be.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're trash trees, Leah. I mean, yes, they're maples, so the fall color is magnificent, but they are tremendously brittle trees. They are the first trees to drop branches during a storm or just because you happen to be walking underneath them. They tend to be short-lived, and most of them were not deliberately planted. They self-seed like mad, so they tend to spring up. And they're very fast growing, and, you know, for the first 10 years or so, they're beautiful trees because of the fall color. But then they start showing their age prematurely. What's going on with yours?
Well, I hear that it's hollow inside. I know some of the limbs are hollow, and I'm worried that it's all the way throughout. The diameter is about 7 feet, so
Whoa.
It's massive, and I love looking at it, but I am getting nervous because of that.
You should be. How close is it to the house?
About 20 feet.
Okay. So how did the leaf out look in the spring?
It looks great. I mean, you wouldn't know if you didn't know that some of the limbs were hollow. You wouldn't know by looking at it. It looks beautiful.
How do you know that some of the limbs are hollow? You've been crawling around inside this thing?
We had it trimmed about 2 years ago. So a lot of the wood that came down was hollow inside.
Okay. What time of year, curiously, did you have it trimmed?
I should know this. I'm guessing fall, late summer, early fall.
Okay, that could have severely weakened the tree.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, the only time you don't want to do any pruning is in late summer, early fall, because the trees, the other plants are going dormant, and pruning stimulates new growth. And as you can imagine, new growth that begins in October or November is going to freeze hard in December, and that takes a toll on the tree.
Okay.
So here's the deal, and you don't see any truly dead parts right now, like branches that are bare with all of the leaves still on the rest of the tree.
I would say there's two of those.
How high up are they? How big are they?
They're pretty big. One's in the center of the tree that runs kind of from the trunk a little higher up. I'd say about at least a foot or two in diameter.
Okay.
So two dead branches.
Here's your choices. The best time to prune big trees is in the dead of winter. One of the problems in the dead of winter is you really can't tell what's going to leaf out and be healthy and what isn't. So the second best time is in the spring. Now, arborists tend to be really busy in the spring, but if you set up an appointment now, what I would suggest, if you want to keep the tree, you start interviewing arborists now. And did you have somebody who climbed into the tree, or did they use a bucket or a crane?
Yeah, it's like a cherry picker or a bucket, yeah.
Yeah. That puts a lot of pressure on the ground underneath, and that stresses the roots. See if you can find a certified arborist who's trained to actually climb up into the tree.
Okay.
And in the spring, after the tree has fully leafed out and you have this person at the ready, have them go up and cut all of the dead wood and then maybe even take out some living branches that don't look like they have long to go. And then anything where the leaves don't look as healthy as the rest of the tree, and then maybe even a little bit of pruning to make things look a little bit more centered, more cultured, and that should improve the health of the tree. Otherwise, you're talking about having the tree taken down, which would involve a crane and many thousands of dollars.
Okay.
Now, the hollowness inside, this is not necessarily a major league problem. As long as the trunk is not girdled in a circle, as long as there are parts of the trunk going all the way up and down the side of the tree, a hole in the side is not as treacherous as it might seem. The tree can grow around that as long as the back of that area is fully formed. It can take nutrients up to the canopy and back down to the roots. And as you know, there's woodpeckers and other creatures living inside there. You see these trees in the forest, and they live for many, many decades.
Well, thank you so much. I was so worried about the hollowness, but you've made me feel a lot better about it. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Leah.
Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody in the land of fall color to use a leaf blower on reverse to suck up and shred all the fall leaves you can for garden mulching and compost making. But don't go looking for all the details under the letter L for leaves in the A to Z answer section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to hinder your herbivores and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hard-working hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's not a question of the week. It's two questions of the week for the price of one. The common denominator is winter. What do you need to do now to protect especially new trees and shrubs from hungry herbivores like deer and rabbits over the winter? And what do you need to do to protect them from the most dangerous creature in your landscape? You. We'll answer both questions after lots more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jordan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how are you?
I am just ducky today. Jordan, how are you, sir?
I'm doing very well.
And where is Jordan doing well?
Well, I'm calling you from West Virginia, but live in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm on the road working right now, but thought I'd give you a call.
All right. What can we do for Jordan, technically near Baltimore?
technically near Baltimore. So purchased a home and needed some work, and we have been fixing up over the last year and just starting a new addition. So it's a pretty substantial addition that's going to involve grading the property. It's probably just over a quarter acre, nothing too large, but it's got some really good plants and shrubs, and the yard has been pretty well kept over the years, unlike the house. So as we put the addition on, the contractors are not the best in taking care of the plants. Their job is to simply dig out foundations and build houses. So knowing that they're going to destroy much of the backyard, I wondered, is it worth my time and effort, and how would certain plants like azaleas, rhododendra, hydrangeas last over the winter if I either potted them in pots or put them in burlap? Is it worth my time and effort to try to save these?
The best way to have a chance of at least getting some of these plants to survive would be what's called healing in. This is what nurseries and garden centers do to get their plants over the winter to survive. Basically planting them fresh in giant mounds of earth, just in different places in the landscape, or if there's no such thing, having a big load of compost delivered and putting the roots into that compost for the winter. Do you have a place where they can be temporarily planted, or a place where you could make like a 6-inch mound somewhere that would accommodate these plants during the construction?
Well, we're going to be moving about 140 cubic yards of dirt, so I'm assuming dirt won't be too hard to come by in the near future. So I could likely find a spot in the yard to move these to.
That would be fine. Believe it or not, the actual engine of destruction that will be involved is also going to be the best way to get these plants out, because you're going to have backhoes on the property, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I've already told them to pull out the plants, some of the larger shrubs, as gently as possible with the backhoes, in the hopes I could save some of them and recycle them in different locations.
If they are handy with the backhoe, they should be able to kind of replicate those giant digger bucket machines that take trees out of the ground, roots and all. So if these guys are capable, they should be able to do it. And you've got a lot of wiggle room. Basically, you want them to make a big mound of earth, you know, maybe a foot, 2 feet tall, ideally. And then you want them to use the backhoe to get underneath these plants deeper than they think possible. And then you're going to need a couple of guys there when the plant comes out of the ground with the backhoe. You're going to want to move it on a tarp. You're going to want to transfer the plant to the tarp and then tarp it over to the area where you've got this big planting area. Put it back into the ground at the same height it was growing in its original location. Continue with that until you've got all the plants in this temporary area. And then I would even suggest getting a drip hose and running it in between the plants and giving them a real good soaking. And even over the winter, anytime the temperatures are above freezing and you haven't had rain or we haven't had snow, give them a long, deep soaking of a couple of hours. Now, don't do that if we get snow cover or if it rains a lot over winter. But if winter's dry, the wind is going to desiccate these plants. So you want to keep putting moisture in the soil. And then especially in the spring, you don't want to rush to replant them, but you do want to be ready with additional water to make sure they don't dry out when and if the winter rains stop in the spring. Keeping as much of the roots intact, and it's perfect because they're going to be going back into the same soil they came out of, replanting them carefully and then keeping them well watered. And I almost guarantee some of them are going to make it. Not every one of them, but you'll take what you can get, right?
Absolutely. If we can spare the expense of purchasing everything new and have some full-grown shrubs, that would be great.
And if you know the azaleas or the rhododendrons start to bloom in their temporary bed, let them finish blooming there, prune them back, and then put them where you want them to be permanently.
All right. Sounds like a plan. I think we're going to give it a shot.
All right. Good luck, Jordan.
All right. Thanks for the help.
Take care, man. 1-888-346-9499. Christo, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you, Christo. Where are you?
I'm here in Glen Mills.
Pennsylvania.
Just outside Media.
Just outside of Philadelphia. Very good. What can we do for you, Chris?
I have two big beds of cotoneaster.
Right.
And since about 2 months, the leaves started to get a little yellow, and I wasn't first concerned. I just thought, they get better again, but they didn't. And now they have reached a stage where they're falling off. And some of the cotonia bushes have turned brown. And now I went to a little garden center near me yesterday, and they said I should check underneath the leaves. And I did, and there were these tiny little rust brown spots.
Were they moving or just disease?
No, they're just like sort of, I rubbed it and then it was sort of powdery.
Okay, that's rust. Now, how long have these plants been in the ground?
They're in the ground 30 years.
Really? So
yeah.
Did you plant them or were they there when you bought the house?
No, we planted them, and I've been so happy with them because all year round I have something to cut off and put in my vases, and they're one of my favorite plants.
Yeah, this is highly unusual. Now, there's many forms of this plant. Are yours deciduous or evergreen?
Evergreen.
Yeah, there are deciduous forms, and there's also semi-forms. It's a big family of plants.
Yeah.
Okay, so I know we've gone through a lot of climate change, and these plants typically do better in areas with cold winters, which is odd because people keep trying to plant them down south, and they don't do very well there. Unfortunately, we haven't had really cold winters either.
Mm-hmm.
Now, have you changed anything about the way you care for them? Did or do you feed them, mulch them, or anything like that?
No, that's the wonderful thing about them. I don't have to do a thing to them.
Okay.
The only thing I do in early spring, I throw down a bit of pre-emergent to keep down the weeds between them. That's it. That's all.
Okay. Pre-emergent herbicides should technically only affect weed seeds. But if you're not careful, you'll get a pre-emergent that also kills existing weeds. It's made only for use on grass. First of all, there's two types of pre-emergents. One are just affecting weed seeds, and mm-hmm. the other type will kill existing non-grass plants.
Oh.
So if you got the type that kills both weeds, living weeds and weeds yet to be born, you kind of poisoned your, I have always called them cotton easters because I'm ignorant, you know, you pronounce their name so beautifully, but they could not tolerate any level of herbicide. Now, are they growing just outside of a lawn that's also treated with herbicides?
Yes, they do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because what you described, now rust obviously is a disease of crowded conditions, of too much moisture, but some of the symptoms you described could be herbicide poisoning. Now, do you water these plants?
No, nothing. I don't do anything to them.
Okay, well, that's not true. The herbicides that you've been using,
yeah. Of course, yes.
On them and around them could have built up to bad levels. Now, you haven't used any herbicides lately, right?
No.
What about on the lawn?
Well, that is being treated, you know, 3 times a year.
Okay.
For grubs and weeds and the fertilizer, of course.
No, not of course. Most times these treatments are just because the person making the treatment can bill you again. Do you have grub problems?
Yes and no. I don't know. Lately, the foxes have been ripping up my lawn. That's another problem I'm having.
I would suggest that if a creature is ripping up your lawn and eating grubs and earthworms, it's probably skunks and not foxes.
No, I saw them.
Really?
Yes.
There must be moles or voles out there because they go for bigger prey. But that's really interesting. And I know you do have a lot of foxes out there in the immediate suburbs. Are all the leaves damaged? Do you have any green evergreen leaves left on the plants?
A few sprigs here and there, but it's mostly all.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, the only thing I can suggest is if you can find some good yard waste compost, shovel that in and amongst the plants. Hopefully they'll green up again in the spring. You got to stop using the herbicides. I have a feeling they've just built up to the level where they're killing everything that's not grass, and it's not good for you either, you realize, to have these chemicals out there. So I would try to change to a more natural lawn care, just making sure the grass is cut high with a sharp blade. Don't forget that if you hire a service, they are going to sell you as many services as they possibly can.
Yeah.
So I think it may be affecting your beloved plants, but let's put down a nice layer of yard waste compost, not composted manure, just quote compost. Soak the soil whenever we don't get rain. We had some really dry stretches over the late summer and early fall. Did you give the plants any extra water?
No, I don't, because in front of the house, half of the day it's in the shade. So the ground there is always moist.
Huh, okay.
Always.
And you know, technically these plants are not supposed to do well in the shade.
But they do.
Yeah, I know. I know. I think maybe without the herbicides, they would have survived the shade, but you start piling up negative conditions on them. So let's hope for the best. Let's hope that they green up in the spring. If they green up halfway, don't be afraid to get out there and prune away any of the dead material. That'll help get rid of the rust. They probably got a little overcrowded out there as well. But I got to warn you, if you keep using herbicides, you're not going to get these plants to come back.
Okay. Well, thank you very, very much.
All right. Good luck, Kristen.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Derek, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how you doing?
I am just Ducky, Derek. Thanks for asking. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
And where is Derek doing great?
We're 50 miles north of Nashville.
Okay. And what's the name of your town?
Clarksville.
All right. What can we do for Derek in Clarksville?
Well, I'm attached to a dogwood I have in my front yard, and I don't want to lose it.
Right.
But it's not looking good.
Mm-hmm.
It is one half. It's kind of split as it grows. It's obviously, it's taller than most dogwoods, but it might be 20 foot tall, maybe. And but it's dying on one half of the Y, and the other side might be following suit, but there is a lot of mold on the trunk and going up the limbs.
On both sides or just the side that already looks half dead?
Yes, the side that looks already half dead, the bark is actually falling off with the mold, and the other side has mold on it, but it's living.
Okay. Dogwoods prefer morning sun, but afternoon shade, especially where you are up in that part of Tennessee. You get some pretty intense summer sun. Does this plant get any afternoon shade?
No, not much.
So it gets sun all day?
Clear. Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Okay. Let's presume that in the dead of winter, Derek's going to go out there with a chainsaw and he's going to start cutting off sections of the dead tree until he gets most of the dead limbs off. What are we going to have left? Is it going to be something you still want to look at?
Yeah, I would do that.
Okay, so when we're cutting down part of a tree or even a whole tree, you don't cut the whole thing down at once. You want to take off sections that are 3 feet long, starting at the top and working your way down carefully and slowly, especially when we're dealing with a tree that's half dead, which is not unusual because were you to try to cut the entire thing at once, the weight of the dead limb falling off could rip the bark off the living part of the tree. So
I think
most important, what we want to do is the part of the tree that comes out of the ground and then goes up to the split, you don't want to touch any of that bark. You want to leave that bark intact. You're just going to take off above the split. You're going to take it off in small sections. Now, the base of the tree, is it clear? Is there any mulch down there?
It's clear. There's really nothing there. I built like a little brick circle around it, but just to maybe put the mulch inside it, but I never got around to it.
Okay. I would get rid of the brick circle.
Okay.
And then the only thing I would put down, if you can find a nice little supply of yard waste compost, start about 6 inches away from the trunk, but then take it out as far as the furthest branch goes. Just a nice black circle underneath what's left of the tree, And then in the spring, did we get good flowers this past spring on the living part of the tree?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You know what, man? I think if you take off that dead arm, which is putting a lot of stress on the tree, if you keep all of the bark intact going up to the split and you put some compost down at the base, I think you've got a good chance. Is it surrounded by a lawn? Do you use herbicides on the lawn?
It's a lawn, but I don't really use anything, but I don't pick up my clippings. I mow it fairly regular, and it's very healthy grass.
Excellent. Excellent. I think that's all we need to do. We need to get all the dead parts off. We need to try to keep that bark intact, put down a layer of compost. And in the spring, when the tree flowers, if you see a couple of dead branches over on the good side, go take those off as well, because they're only going to be sucking energy out of the tree. So I think it may look a little lopsided, but I think my gut instinct is this tree is going to survive and do really well for you.
Oh, that would be great. I don't want to lose it. I've grown attached to it.
All right. Well, I think this is the plan, man.
Thank you very much for your help.
All right. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will be honored to once again host the Empty Bowl Dinner to benefit homeless families on Wednesday evening, November 15th, at the Lutheran Theological Seminary on Germantown Avenue in Philadelphia. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to defeat deer, confiscate your cutters, and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hard-working hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and yes, we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to a double-barreled question of the week. What do you need to do to protect your plants from hungry creatures like rabbits and deer over the winter? And what do you need to do to protect them from the most dangerous creature of all in their environment, which of course is you? We'll answer those burning questions after a couple more of your burning phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Elaine, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Elaine. How are you?
I'm terrific. How are you doing?
I am just ducky, thank you. Where is Elaine terrific?
Well, I'm terrific in Brooklyn, but the question is about our place in Upper Bucks County.
Oh, okay. So you commute from Brooklyn. Forget about it. to Bucks County, huh?
Yep, every weekend.
All right. That's a heck of a commute. God bless you for that. But they're both great places. I love Brooklyn.
So do we, but we're loving the country life as well.
Yeah, well, you can get the best of both. I lived in Brooklyn once when I worked at Marvel Comics. Great communities in there. All right, what can we do for Elaine, who crosses state lines with intention to commit horticulture?
My husband and I have been passionate asparagus growers for about the past 4 years in our raised beds. We have a lot of asparagus harvest in springtime, but the oddest thing has just happened. We have just cut it back to prepare it, put compost on, and oddly enough, we have about 30 to 40 asparagus growing right now, and we don't know what to do. Should we just let them grow and die? Should we cut them? And how is it going to affect next spring's harvest?
I thought we had had some weird falls in the past. We've had some strange climactic conditions. This year, I have not been to a single landscape where I haven't seen something odd. My peace rose is still producing new flushes of roses all the time. I see flowers on azaleas and rhododendrons and other spring bloomers all over the place. And I was out on my back deck the other night and could smell the scent of Japanese honeysuckle blooming in the woods. So this is nature at her absolute craziest. We've had several warm winters in a row. I don't need to tell you that this fall has been much nicer than summer in terms of temperature. Sometimes it's been too darn hot. And every place I go, everybody says the same thing. Boy, I enjoy this weather, but I'm not going to enjoy it when the check comes. I don't know what we're going to do to pay for this, but it's going to be ugly.
Exactly.
Well, as people who grow asparagus, let's just go through the basics. The new spears come up in the spring, and the first couple of years you're supposed to let them go to help establish the bed because, as you know, the little baby spears will grow big and fat, and then they'll put on fern-like fronds, and those fronds absorb solar energy to make the root system stronger. Then after the second or third year, you harvest the little baby thin asparagus when it comes up, and you stop when the new spears begin being smaller than a pencil. That means the root system is starting to get tired, and you want to let those last spears frowned out, so to speak, and absorb solar energy. And then you can cut them down now, or you can let them stand over winter. It is highly unusual to get a fall crop of asparagus. But as I'm thinking this through, there's no way these spears are going to have a chance to mature and develop fronds. Even if they did, the hours of daylight are getting markedly shorter, and the angle of the daylight is not ideal at all for photosynthesis. So to make a short answer very lengthy, I'm going to say cut them and eat them.
Okay, well, we have a dinner on the horizon.
Yeah, you know, this is when the asparagus comes in from the other side of the planet. This is when the asparagus, seriously, comes in from Australia and places like that because it's spring down there. Normally, I wouldn't have any idea what to do, but since we know these things are only helpful to the crowns if they can mature and put out those solar collectors, we know that that can't happen. So you might as well cut them and eat them.
Okay, so we will do that, and thank you so much for your advice.
And then really put down a lot of compost over the beds to help replenish this, because this is going to be sucking some energy out of the root system.
All right, we will try doing that this weekend.
All right, good luck, Elaine.
Thank you so much.
All right, you take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Michelle, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thank you, Michelle. How are you?
I'm great today. How about you?
I am just ducky, thank you for asking. Where is Michelle great?
Okay, we are great in Bayside, California, which is right on the Humboldt Bay, far, far northern California.
All right. What can we do for Michelle in far northern California?
Well, long ago, we have family gatherings where we all go out berry picking, blackberries, Himalayas and regular blackberries. We, two summers ago, we had a huge family go out to one of our favorite plots in Freshwater, California, picked lots and lots of berries, and then everyone was noticing lots of worms crawling around in the berries. And we opened up the berries. We found that they were inside, right near where the stem hits the berry.
Mm-hmm.
We've never seen that before, and we decided to discard all these family berries. We also went to another community called Blue Lake, which is just a few miles more inland from Humboldt Bay. Same thing was happening there. And I haven't touched a blackberry since. I hadn't ever seen that before. I don't know how new that is. And our biggest question is it okay if we eat those?
Well, it's interesting because we have a new pest here on the East Coast, a spotted winged fruit fly that is infesting raspberry crops. And as you know, raspberries and blackberries are very closely related. These pests tend not to be able to cross over the Rockies very easy, so I don't know if it started on the West Coast and found its way here. I believe it's an Asian pest, so maybe you were the first stop off. But I know California in general has always had Mediterranean fruit fly problems. There was all those issues with them spraying malathion all the time, and people worried about their health, and it also took the paint off the cars. So the bottom line is, whatever the exact nature of the pest is, it is a little fruit fly. It's laying its eggs inside the soft fruits, which are an easy target. And then there's, you know, the quote worms are actually maggots, to make the situation sound worse and less appetizing. So two things. First, there is absolutely no harm in eating these things, unless, of course, you're a vegetarian, and then you probably don't want them. Back going to our prehistoric ancestors, these were valuable sources of protein. We did a relatively notorious show a couple of years back where we had an entomologist come on the air with fried crickets and fried mealworms for me to eat, and they were scrumptiously-umptious.
Okay.
So not only is there no issue, they're not going to breed in our bodies. It's not like, what's the terrible TV show, The Creature Inside Me or whatever. They're not going to breed inside us, and they are tremendously rich sources of protein. They're also disgusting. So what I'm going to suggest, which is an old trick to get rid of the caterpillars that are often found on heads of broccoli, you know, that look exactly the same color as the broccoli worm, so to speak, but it's a caterpillar. Everything gets called a worm that looks like that. I would take the blueberries and I would get a big container of plain, cool water. And then I would rig up a situation where I could get something like a window screening that fit inside the container, just a tiny bit smaller, so that you could push it down and keep the blueberries underwater. You keep the blueberries underwater for about 5-10 minutes, and all the little worms are going to come out. And then you just sieve them out, and then you would have pretty much worm-free blackberries. I hate to see the fruit go uneaten. Now, if somebody wants to be the ultimate omnivore, believe it or not, we're kind of talking, once you combine these two things, of a perfect meal. You've got all the phytonutrients that are in blackberries, one of the top five foods for naturally occurring vitamins and naturally occurring medicines. And then you've got a great source of protein in the little wormy guys. So there's no harm in doing that. But I think if you rig up a cold water bath where you can keep the blueberries underwater for a good 10 minutes without squishing them or harming them, you wouldn't change the taste or the texture at all, and you get rid of the worms.
Okay, so they will come up out of, they seem to be inside the berry cells.
Yes, but they're breathing in there, and once their oxygen supply is cut off, they're going to try to get out of there.
Okay.
And you're going to need to do experiments, because I haven't done this personally. I've heard about it for broccoli. They come out pretty quickly for that, but yours are deeper inside, so it might take an hour or two, but I think you can get rid of most or all of them by keeping them under cold water.
All right, that sounds good. I might give it a try. I may go back to that wonderful fruit.
Yeah, you got to. It's just too precious to waste.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Mike.
All right. Good luck, Michelle.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, it's time for the question of the week. This week, a doubleheader, which we're calling Protecting Plants from Winter, Deer, Wabbits, and from you. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started by reading the first of two questions this week.
Sure, Mike. Tom in South Jersey, about 5 minutes east of Philadelphia, writes, I have a huge butterfly bush. It grows to around 8 feet tall and 6 feet wide each summer. But the growth is not that sturdy. When it sleets or snows, the branches get bent down low or break off. How and when should I prune the plant in the fall to prepare it for winter? I have heard your advice to not prune in the fall, as it promotes new growth when the plant is preparing to go dormant. But my neighbors cut their butterfly bush back hard as part of their fall cleanup, and it survives. But it's not nearly as large or hardy as mine.
Ha! I'll bet it's not as nice. The fact that their plant even survives is a testament to the bulletproof nature of butterfly bush, Latin name Bedelia. If Tom values how good his looks in the summer, he should not follow their foolish lead.
As you've explained many times, cutting perennials back in fall or winter exposes the underground root system to severe winter injury. Leaving the dormant plant's biomass on top insulates and protects the roots.
So leave it alone now and through winter. Then, because it's a summer bloomer, cut it back as low as you want about 2 weeks after new growth resumes in the spring. And come on, let's be realistic here. You'd get bent to the ground if you got left outside in an ice storm, pal. If a couple of branches wind up blocking a pathway in the winter, prune them off when the plant is fully dormant. But don't otherwise, quote, clean up any perennials. It's a remarkably bad idea.
You asked me to remind you to also say a word of warning about this plant.
Oh, yeah. Bedelia is not native to the United States. It's an Asian plant that's been banned for sale in some areas because it readily self-seeds and can become invasive. It is also not a known host plant for any caterpillar, but it does provide huge amounts of pollen and nectar for pollinators and butterflies. I was recently given one that hosted dozens of different species of native bees over this summer. I also saw quite a few honeybees, so I'm guessing that somebody in my neighborhood has a hive or two.
We move on to Anne in Medford, Oregon, who writes, I planted a darling brown turkey fig in my garden. It's a Mediterranean plant, and I have a somewhat Mediterranean climate. Perfect, right? I planted it in mid-September as the temperatures were cooling and the Oregon rains were beginning. Perfect planning, perfect execution, right? Sadly, the deer stripped it bare and continue to do so anytime fresh leaves emerge. My husband and I planned a fence in our little property this winter. In the meantime, do you think the fig can survive until spring? My husband says yes. I say no. Tell us your prediction. P.S. I am sharing your wisdom about using red wigglers to make compost and worm bins, and my friends are all on board.
Excellent. This is a perfect time of year to get a worm bin started. And the stackable ones with removable trays make great holiday gifts for homeowners who want to correctly and efficiently compost their food waste. My personal worm tower is still going strong after more than a decade.
Yeah, yeah, we know you love your wormies. Now, what is your figgy prediction?
A strong chance of survival. Now, if this were another type of plant, like an apple or a peach tree, it might not survive a high level of browsing. Even if they don't attack the mature form of the plant, deer are always going to eat the bark of tender new trees and shrubs. And a conventional tree will be killed if they eat a complete circle around the trunk.
But figs grow back from their roots in the spring and almost always survive, especially in the kind of mild winter climate she describes.
Right, so I suggest she simply erect a big cage of welded wire fencing around the plant to prevent further damage, especially in the upcoming spring when lots of nibbling could prevent the figs from having enough time to ripen up.
Yeah, but she says they're going to fence everything in.
Uh-huh. And I said I'd get enough filing done in my office so that you could finally see the floor again. I think that was back around 2010. So cage the tree.
And I'm guessing that just about everyone with new plantings should protect them now.
Absolutely. Deer, rabbits, mice, and voles do the worst damage in the winter when their natural food becomes scarce. Young or valuable trees and shrubs should always be protected. One way to do this is with sprays of deer repellent, heavy at the base of the plant to deter small herbivores, and then heavy again at browsing height, which is roughly 28 to 36 inches off the ground for deer. Or you can use hardware cloth to protect the base of the plant from vermin. Be sure to make it go high enough to account for snow, and a sturdy cage around the outskirts for deer, and that cage will also deter antler rubbing. Well, that sure was some interesting information about protecting your plants over winter, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to put a cage around me if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email with your location. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore with your location at garden@whyy.org. Oh, and please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you will find the answers to all of those garden questions you are going to send us, audio this show, past shows, and our podcast. We continue to send get well wishes to Elizabeth Perez Luna, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter continues to play our theme song. Our parole officer, Sweet Staven Naomi Sterobin, has recommended house arrest. Our arresting engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz have done something weird to our website. Arresting Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, says, we have a website? We have no information on the arrest record of our intern, Robert Fogarty. Our head chairman, associate producer of Vice Presidential Production Association is Brett Rader. We shall say no more. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and if nobody cuts me back to the ground, I'll see you again next week. Maybe in a cage. Would just be for protection. Honest. It's like that movie where Olivia de Havilland gets stuck in an old school elevator just as a motorcycle gang happens to wander into her house. What are the odds on that? I'd say 1-1. What can you expect to hear next week? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I have no idea what we're going to do. Only that it will be fun and that I will get into trouble. Plus your fabulous phone calls.